This is podcast number 74 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm sharing lessons from the life of Mary McLeod Bethune. Many years ago, when I was involved with a little school in Africa with a friend, she asked me if I could put together a story of someone to inspire the hearts of some of these young girls. I love the story of Mary Bethune because it shows what faith and determination can overcome. So I put together this story that I'm going to share with you in this podcast. One of Mary's greatest desires was to go to Africa and teach the children there, but it never happened in her lifetime. When my friend carried the story over there, I thought perhaps through her story, her influence will be a small realization of her dream. At least I like to think of that. Here's the story. How does a little girl, born under the poorest of circumstances, grow up to be a friend and advisor of presidents, guest of royalty, founder of a college, and an inspiration to millions of people? This is the story of Mary McLeod Bethune. All her life, she worked with youth. She begged for them and fought for them. Hers was not an easy road, but she said very few of her generation found life easy or wanted it that way. She overcame staggering obstacles. In her own words, "I'm poor and I'm ugly and I'm not very smart, but the Lord has chosen me for an instrument." She shows us how all things are possible when one has faith in God and faith in oneself. The day Mary McLeod came into the world, July 10, 1875, was a joyous occasion. Although she was the 15th of Sam and Patsy McLeod's 17 children, this was the first child born to them in freedom. The Civil War had just ended and slavery was abolished. That meant there would be no worrying in the middle of the night if this baby in a few years would be sold and sent away to another master. This baby was theirs to raise. Mary was born into a simple log cabin with few material goods. A treasured Bible, even though no one in the household knew how to read, was kept on the shelf next to a blue china pitcher, a sewing box, and an oil lamp. But hers was a home full of love. Both of her parents had been born into slavery. One day her father was visiting a neighboring plantation where he first saw Patsy and immediately knew he wanted to be with her. She had soft, keen features and spoke with a gentle voice. She carried herself like a queen, which was only natural for one who came from a long line of African royalty. The slave owners had tried to erase any memories of the slaves' former lives in Africa, but Patsy's mother made sure she kept the stories of her family's heritage alive. Sam needed his master's permission to marry her. He got the permission, but first had to earn enough money to buy her from her current owner. Sam was willing to do anything to be with Patsy. So for 2 years, he walked an extra 6 miles a day after his normal chores were done, where he put in long, hard hours hauling lumber, putting aside every penny he could earn. Finally, the wedding day arrived, and a wedding dress and a suit were provided to make their day special. They became a well-respected, hard-working couple who were devoted to each other for the rest of their lives. When Mary was 9 or 10 years old, something happened that hurt her very much, but proved to be a driving force that changed her life. It was not unusual for slaves, after being freed, to continue working for former masters to earn money. Patsy often returned to the Wilsons to cook for them or to help with laundry. When Mary was old enough, she was allowed to go with her. This particular day, Mr. Wilson's golden-haired granddaughters invited Mary out to their playhouse. Mary looked around wide-eyed at the dolls with beautiful silk dresses and delicate shoes. There were slates and pencils and magazines and books all around. She walked over to a table and opened a book that was sitting there. Immediately, one of the granddaughters snatched the book away and slammed it shut. "Don't you touch that book with your black hands. Don't you know reading is for white folk? You can't never read. You are black." It was true that during the years of slavery, many states had put laws into effect forbidding anyone from teaching a black person to read. It wasn't laws that kept them from reading now, just no one willing to teach them. Nevertheless, the words, "you can't read," pierced Mary's heart. She made up her mind right then and there that somehow, someday, she was going to learn how to read. She had seen the comfortable homes the white boys and girls lived in and the opportunities they had that she didn't, and she sensed, even at her young age, that knowing how to read had something to do with the difference. As she walked back home past the broken-down shanties of her people, she told her mother of her dream to learn how to read. She said, "You know, my mother was one of those grand educated persons that did not have letters. She had a great vision, a great understanding of human nature. When I told her, she said to me, 'Child, your day will come. You will learn someday.' My mother had a great philosophy of life. She could not be discouraged. No matter what kind of plight we found ourselves in, she always believed there was, through prayer and work, a way out. And it was one of the greatest things she stimulated life with, that determination that there was a way out if we put forth effort ourselves." And so Mary's prayers began in earnest. "Please, Lord, help me find a way to learn how to read." You had to be strong and fast to work in the cotton fields, and Mary was both. One day as she was working her way down the cotton rows, her mother and father not far away, she looked up to see a stranger walking toward them. It was Miss Emma Wilson, a teacher with light brown skin, who had just been given authorization by the Presbyterian Church to open a school, and she was looking for students. Sam and Patsy could only spare one of their children because there was so much work to be done, but there was no question which of their children it would be. Mary sank to her knees, raised her hands toward heaven, and thanked God for hearing her prayers. The 5 miles each way to the little school in Maysville was more like an adventure than a hardship. The school wasn't much to look at, a small one-room shack with hard wooden benches inside. But Mary remembered her teacher's beautiful smile she always had on her face, and she remembered her patience and her tenderness and the kindly way she handled the students. They were not afraid of her. They could approach her at any time. Years later, Mary became that kind of teacher. Mary was an eager learner and was reading in a very short time. Every Sunday afternoon, she would gather the farm children from miles around to teach them whatever she had learned during the week. Poetry, reading, songs. In her words, "I would give to them as often as I got. As I got, I gave. They gave me a broader capacity for taking in, and I feel that up to today, I feel it in all things, and I feel that as I give, I get." As soon as she could do counting, all the papers of both the whites and the colored people were put in her lap. They wanted to make sure they weren't being cheated when they took their cotton in to be weighed. Unfortunately, for the most part, they had been cheated. Many of her neighbors started turning a profit for the first time and were able to pay off their mortgages with Mary's help. She said, "I became useful. I won their respect and admiration. I made my learning, what little it was, just from the beginning, spell service and cooperation, rather than something that would put me above the people around me. When I went off to school and came back, I was accepted and they looked forward to my coming back. They knew that whatever I had, they knew I would adapt to use of the people there." For the first time, the people of her community saw in Mary something to aspire to. They had never before seen what their possibilities were. She brought a desire to learn and an understanding that they just did not have to continue in darkness, that there was a chance. After 4 years at the little school in Maysville, when Mary was just 15, Miss Wilson told Mary there was nothing else she could teach her. So Mary went back to the cotton fields, praying all the time for a way to open up to get more education. It would cost money, though, something they didn't have. As if the way didn't already seem impossible, one day her dad came into the house and announced that Old Bush had collapsed and died in the fields. Old Bush was their mule, the single most important possession of their family. Without the mule, there could be no plowing. No plowing meant no crops. No crops, no money. No money, definitely no school. Whatever money they did earn would have to first go towards replacing the mule. Never ones to give in to discouragement, Mary's older brother, without a word, went over to the plow and strapped the harness around his own waist. It would be hard and strenuous work, but each member of the family took a turn pulling the plow. Meanwhile, many hundreds of miles away in Denver, Colorado, a schoolteacher, Mary Chrisman, had faithfully been setting aside a tenth of her meager earnings for many years. She had supplemented her teaching salary by sewing dresses when school wasn't in session and was waiting for the right opportunity to use the money to help someone who needed it. When she became aware of the plight of the former slaves and their children who had little opportunity for education, she sent the money to the Presbyterian Board to be used as a scholarship by someone who would make good with it. She could have scarcely imagined at the time the good that would come from her modest donation. Can you imagine the excitement Miss Wilson had the day she once again found Mary in the cotton fields and was able to deliver the good news? Mary was astonished. Why, this woman didn't even know who she was. "Oh, the joy of that glorious morning, I can never forget it," is the way she herself told the story. "To this day my heart thrills with gratitude at the memory of that day. I was but a little girl, groping in the light, dreaming dreams and seeing visions in the cotton and rice fields, and away off in Denver, Colorado, a poor dressmaker, sewing for her daily bread, heard my call and came to my assistance. Out of her scanty earnings, she invested in a life, my life, and while God gives me strength, I shall strive to pass on to others the opportunities that this noble woman toiled and sacrificed to give me." For a second time, she pulled off her cotton sack, got down on her knees, clasped her hands, and turned her eyes upward to thank God for the chance that had come. The whole community was excited about Mary's selection to go to Scotia Seminary. Some neighbors knitted her a little linsey dress and socks and provided other clothes she would need. Her father bought her a trunk to pack her belongings. All the neighbors stopped work that October afternoon to see their Mary take her very first train ride. Her arrival at the new school was full of so many firsts. It was the first brick building she had ever seen. She climbed her first stairs, slept in her very own bed with crisp linens for the very first time, ate with a fork, and saw people with black skin and people with white skin eating at the same table as equals. Mary quickly made friends with everyone there. It would seem her greatest gift was the ability to love absolutely everyone. Homesick girls always found her. Girls came with their problems, difficulties, and disappointments for her advice. The scholarship didn't cover all of Mary's expenses, so she worked any way she could find, doing laundry, cooking, scrubbing. She said, "Nothing was too menial or too hard for me to find joy in doing for the appreciation of having a chance." Mary was starved for learning and couldn't get enough. She never considered herself an exceptional student, but took advantage of everything offered during her 7 years at Scotia. She learned public speaking and debate, and discovered she had a beautiful contralto voice. She had so many questions and soon learned she could find answers at books in the library. It was in books she learned such principles as inalienable rights and the history of her people. Why had there been slavery? It must have hurt her heart as she read how her ancestors were kidnapped by traders, dragged away in chains from their homes and families in Africa, and placed in stinking, rat-infested holds of ships, many dying along the way. Once in America, they were sold as property. Reading such things reawakened in her heart desires that had been placed there years earlier as she listened to a Reverend Bone tell the stories of the people in darkest Africa. She had decided long before that her life's work was to travel to Africa as a missionary and bring light to the people there. She shared her ambitions with her principal, who helped her make application to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, where she could be trained as a missionary. Her 2 years at Moody included much time on the streets, learning how to reach out and help the less fortunate. One time her missionary group had traveled to the Dakotas, where they spent the night at the home of a minister and his wife. They had a 5-year-old daughter who had never seen someone with black skin before, but immediately fell in love with Mary. When it came time for dinner, the little girl, not understanding, said, "Mother, tell the lady to wash her face and hands. She's all dirty." The parents were embarrassed and started to apologize, but Mary simply smiled and said, "I'm not ashamed at all of my color. I'm proud of my black skin." Then she lifted the girl up on her lap and let her touch her skin so she could see the color would not rub off. "Look, My skin is just like your skin. It stays the way God made it. Then she took a vase of flowers from a nearby stand and held it in front of her. Look at all the different colors of these flowers. God made men just the way he made flowers, some one color, some another, so that when they are gathered together, they make a beautiful bouquet. A grateful mother thanked her for her graciousness and this most important lesson that had been taught to her daughter. As soon as graduation day was over, Mary traveled to New York, anxious and excited to receive her missionary appointment to Africa. However, the members of the board explained there was simply no opening for her at that time. Her whole life, Mary regretted that she was not able to go to Africa, and described that was the greatest disappointment of her life. It was with a heavy heart she accepted, instead, an assignment to teach school at Haynes Norbel Institute in Augusta, Georgia. It was there she met Lucy Laney, who taught her that there was much work to be done right in America for her people. Other teaching assignments followed. One day, a tall, handsome young man appeared at choir practice. His name, Albertus Bethune. The two fell in love and were married a short time later. Their only son, Albert, Sam and Patsy's 90th grandchild, came quickly. She adored her new little baby, but a new dream had taken hold of Mary. She dreamed of opening a school for little girls so they could be given all the same advantages and opportunities that had been given to her. Even though Albertus was a teacher, he didn't share his wife's passion for education, and although they were friendly towards each other, most of their 19 years of marriage were spent apart. He died long before seeing Mary achieve the great successes of her life. Mary carefully considered where to open this new school. She wanted it to be in a place that was hard. She wanted it to be somewhere where no one else was reaching out to help the children. She found out that a railroad was being built down the eastern coast of Florida, and that many of the workers had their families with them. So she took the 3-day trip down to Daytona, arriving with just $1.50 and her dreams. As she walked down the dusty streets, she saw broken-down shacks and dirty children running wild everywhere. This would be the perfect place. The first order of business? Find a building to hold class. At the end of a peninsula with the ocean in view, she saw an old empty shack, nothing beyond it but an old dump heap. Most of the paint had peeled off and the windows were broken or cracked. She held on to a rickety stair rail as she climbed the wobbly stairs and looked inside. It was filled with cobwebs and had a leaky roof, but it would do just fine. She located the owner, who wanted $11 a month in rent. Problem was, she didn't have anything. But there was something about Mary that made the owner trust that she would find the money somehow. She quickly found her first 5 students, 5 little girls who helped scrub and clean the old shack to get it ready. The neighbors pitched in too, clearing the weeds away and nailing boards back in place. Mary started scouring the junk piles for anything usable, cracked dishes, old lamps, even clothes thrown out behind hotels were brought back to be cleaned up and mended. Old crates and barrels were used for desks and chairs. She didn't have any pencils, so she used charcoal slivers from burned logs. Elderberry juice was used for ink. She made sure the few supplies she was able to buy from the store were wrapped individually in paper. The paper was brought back to the school and smoothed out and flattened so the girls would have something to write on. October 3, 1904 was the big opening day of the Daytona Educational and Industrial Training School for Negro Girls. Over the door was written the words, "Enter to learn, depart to serve." Mary knew just what to teach. She said, "This is a new kind of school. I'm going to teach my girls crafts and homemaking. I'm going to teach them to earn a living. They will be trained in head, heart, and hand. Their heads to think, their hands to work, and their hearts to have faith." The burden of having to raise money was to be Mary's constant companion. She was able to acquire an old used bicycle, and once a week she could be seen riding up and down the streets, knocking on doors, begging for money. Many were kind to her and even grew to look forward to her visits, but others were downright rude. I had learned already that one of my most important jobs was to be a good beggar. I rang doorbells and tackled cold prospects without a lead. I wrote articles for whoever would print them, distributed leaflets, wrote interminable miles of dusty roads on my old bicycle, invaded churches, clubs, lodges, chambers of commerce. If a prospect refused to make a contribution, I'd say, "Thank you for your time." No matter how deep my hurt, I always smiled. I refused to be discouraged, for neither God nor man can use a discouraged person. One day she had an idea. Sweet potatoes down there in Florida were plentiful and dirt cheap, and she knew how to cook up the tastiest sweet potato pie. She had her girls get up early in the morning with her, and they'd boil and peel the sweet potatoes. By the time the railroad workers got off work, she was right there with her delicious, fresh pieces of pie, which they eagerly bought. Daytona Beach had become the winter retreat for many of the wealthy white northerners. She taught her girls how to sing the beautiful spiritual hymns of the South and would take them to perform at the fine hotels nearby. They caught the attention of many prominent people who looked forward to their performances and rewarded them handsomely with donations. She believed, like Gandhi, that no good cause suffers from the want of money, and added trustfully, "God will shake money out of the trees." One Saturday night, she went to the grocer's and pled with him to carry just $4 more on her account until the next week. There was no food at home for her girls, and she couldn't bear for them to go hungry. He firmly refused. As she approached her school, trusting that God would somehow provide, there were 4 scruffy-looking men on her porch. At first she was alarmed, but then she recognized them as students who attended some of her classes as adults. They said that they had just been paid and wanted to thank her for what she had taught them. Each held out $1, which Mary thankfully took and rushed back to the store for the groceries. She had learned from Lucy Laney that a school had to be properly organized with a board of trustees who could advise and help her. She perused the society pages of the newspaper and decided on the name of James N. Gamble of Procter & Gamble. She sat down and wrote him a letter, to which a prompt reply came back, inviting her to his home at noon the next day. She pedaled her old bicycle, arriving at his house 15 minutes early. Wanting to impress him with promptness, she had borrowed a watch and waited for the exact strike of noon before she strode up to the front door. Mr. Gamble looked surprised at the woman who was ushered into his study. "Are you the woman trying to build the school here? Why, I thought you were a white woman." The jet-black Mary Bethune burst out laughing. "Well, you see how white I am." She didn't want to waste his time, so she quickly told him how desperately the school was needed and invited him to serve as one of its trustees. He appeared interested, but seemed to hesitate just a bit, so Mary quickly invited him to take a look at the school. He agreed to a visit the next day. Mary hurried home and quickly enlisted the help of her girls to scrub and clean and straighten so that everything would be in order for their distinguished guest. A tall, slim, white-haired Mr. Gamble showed up the next day in his chauffeured car. He looked around in amazement, staring at the wooden crates used as desks, and the students lined up in their altered, mended, and patched dresses. "Just where is this school that you want me to take a look at?" Mary had always looked at her school through the eyes of her dreams, and having this visitor must have been a harsh reality check. But she straightened herself and with great confidence replied, "In my mind and in my spirit, I'm asking you to be a trustee of a glorious dream, trustee of the hope I have in my heart for my people." Mr. Gamble was a kindly and gracious man and must have been quite taken in by this courageous woman who had done so much with so little. He instantly agreed and handed her a check for $150. The first of a lifetime of generous donations by this good man. With Mr. Gamble on board, it wasn't as hard to attract others who willingly became friends and partners of Mary Bethune's dream. The school was growing and new buildings needed to go up. True to her nature, she moved forward, not quite knowing how it was going to come about, but trusting a way would be provided. She doubled and redoubled her begging efforts. "I hung on to contractors' coattails, begging for loads of sand and second-hand bricks. I went to all the carpenters, mechanics, and plasterers in town, pleading with them to contribute a few hours' work in the evening in exchange for sandwiches and tuition for their children or themselves. As soon as the roof went up, she moved her students in, even though the building was far from finished. Often the construction would have to stop altogether until more funds were found. It was at one of her choir's performances at the Palmetto Hotel that her path first crossed with a gentleman who would become a great benefactor of her school. He placed a $20 bill in the collection plate. Such a generous donation. Not too many days later, Mary was on her usual cycling rounds when a huge automobile drove up to her side and stopped. "Aren't you the one I saw with the children at the Palmetto Hotel?" Without another word, he had a chauffeur put Mary's bike in the back of the car, and they drove back to her school. He looked around at the unfinished construction, at the unplastered walls, at the homemade mattresses made from boiled, dried Spanish moss from the trees that were then stuffed in corn sacks. He noticed a bag of meal standing in the corner and asked what else there was to eat. Mary replied that was all they had at the moment. He walked over to where a young girl struggled to sew on an old, broken-down Singer sewing machine. He turned back to Mary and said, "I believe you were on the right track. This is the most promising thing I've seen in Florida," and handed her a check for $200. The visitor was Mr. Thomas H. White, manufacturer of White sewing machines. I wept, called the children in for a special meeting. We knelt and thanked God. He came back the next day with a new sewing machine and with an architect and carpenter, and they brought materials and plaster to put on the walls. And he said, "I will have bathrooms put in." He brought pillow slips and sheets. Often he would drop by with a few pairs of shoes or blankets or whatever he thought they might need. Tears of gratitude would fill Mary's eyes whenever he came by, but his simple reply to her was, "I've never invested a dollar that has brought greater returns than the dollars I've given you." That building was named Faith Hall and officially opened in 1907, prayed up, sung up, and talked up in 2 years. Mary now had 250 girls who looked up to her as a mother. The field across the street had been cleared, and they were taught to plant and grow vegetables and strawberries. They were of such a quality that well-to-do people traveled from all around to buy their produce there. There needed to be more buildings built, which meant more land to be purchased. She found the owner of the old dump next door. He wanted an outrageous $1,000 for that piece of property. Mary had grown confident in her bargaining power and asserted herself. "I don't suppose you know this, sir, but people around here call this land of yours Hell's Hole. It's full of mosquitoes, weeds, and snakes. The way it is, I'm not sure it's good for anything." The man lowered the price down to $200, $5 down and $5 a month until it was paid off. He didn't know it at the time, but Mary didn't even have the $5 down payment. But she knew she could get it. Once again, neighbors pitched in and drained the swamp, clearing out the weeds and debris along the way. Bushes and shrubs, flowers and trees were planted in place of it, and it became a beautiful piece of property. One Sunday, Mary took her girls for a picnic out by the piney woods. She had heard about the turpentine camps. These were horrible places. The riffraff around town had been hired to drain the sap out of the pine trees to make turpentine in exchange for all the rum they could drink on the weekends. Sadly, some of them had brought their families with them, and the conditions they lived in would make anyone shudder. Drunks were sprawled out on the ground everywhere, and she saw ragged, unkempt women hiding timidly in the trees. Sickness was all around. They looked more like animals than human beings. At first, her girls were reluctant to be there, but Mary encouraged them to have faith. She invited as many as would to gather together into a meeting. At first, they laughed. They jeered, even told vulgar jokes, rum bottles in hand. But Mary started to sing a hymn in her beautiful contralto voice, and soon the girls joined in. Then they sang another hymn, followed by another. The laughter started to die down. The rum bottles were lowered to the ground. She now had their attention, and she spoke to them with simple, eloquent words, encouraging them to a better life. She said she would return each Sunday and that eventually she would start a school for their children where they could learn to read and write and sew. As she gained their confidence, she was invited to their homes, such as they were, and showed them how to clean and make them pretty. She had always taught her students that neatness, cleanliness, and beauty in the home were like another kind of prayer to God. Week after week, Mary and her girls sang and read to them. They encouraged and admonished them. The girls were able to practice their nursing skills, and many of the people of the Turpentine camps felt human again, like they were a part of the world again. 5 mission schools were set up in the camps over the next 5 years. Wherever Mary saw a need, she would say, "I prayed to God to let me do something about that." One of her young girls became deathly ill with acute appendicitis. Mary tried in vain to find a hospital that would treat her. All refused because she had the wrong color of skin. Finally, she found a doctor who compassionately agreed to perform the surgery. Mary left her in his care, but was outraged when she returned the next day and found the little girl left to herself on a cot on a drafty back porch. This was just not acceptable. Mary stayed up all night writing letters, begging for money to raise the $5,000 she would need to open a small hospital that could treat her people. Within a month, she had the money, and within a short time, McLeod Hospital, named after her father, was dedicated. The Ku Klux Klan was a dreaded secret society of those who hated, among other things, people with colored skin. They used fear as a weapon to force people into compliance with what they wanted. They stopped at nothing to exert their power, burning buildings, torturing, and even killing innocent victims. It was no secret that Mary had long been teaching her people to courageously stand up for their inalienable rights. The next day was to be another election day, and rumor was the Klan was riding out to Mrs. Bethune's school that night to persuade her it would be in her best interest to keep her people away from the voting polls. This was not a time to show cowardice in any way. Mary ordered every light to be turned on in the school. She encouraged the choir to continue its practice as usual and fearlessly placed herself in between the 2 white columns on the steps leading up to the school. What an imposing figure she must have been, her long cape fluttering in the wind. She waited. Maybe they weren't coming after all. But then, out in the darkness, she could see the flicker of flames coming closer, the muffled sound of horses' hoofs making their way toward her. Silently, 80 ghostly figures lined up in front of her, their eyes glaring from behind their hooded masks. "We hear you're teaching colored folks around here to vote. We've just come to warn you about filling their heads with such ideas." They threatened her that if she didn't stop, they would come back and burn every building until there was nothing left. Mary was more angry than afraid now. She straightened herself up and with deliberate words told them, "If you must burn my buildings, go ahead. But let me tell you, once you've burned them, I'll build them back again. Then if you burn them a second time, I'll build them again, and again, and again." She must have been startled by her own boldness. But slowly, the masked men turned and walked back out into the dark of night. They left behind the can of kerosene, which the groundskeeper quickly retrieved. The school could use it. The next morning, Mary led a procession of 100 voters, many of them exercising their rights for the very first time. They were kept waiting all day, but they voted. The story of this obscure schoolteacher in Florida who had stood up to the Klan made newspaper headlines all over America. Mrs. Bethune was becoming a speaker in high demand. She raised awareness of the needs of her people, of the need for equal rights and opportunities. She would be seated on the stands in her plain, shabby clothes, next to prominent and fashionably dressed club members. But Henry Winslow observed, "There was a magnificent dignity about her person and carriage that awed her audiences." People who heard her speak said she was electrifying. Her natural ability to unite and organize, combined with her warmth and dignity, soon led to her appointment as the president of the National Association of Colored Women. Her school had grown and was now a fully accredited college, admitting men as well as women after a merger with Cookman College. Friends convinced her to turn the college over to other capable hands as the level of her influence widened. She never kept any of the money she raised for herself, but when friends offered to pitch in and pay for her to enjoy a trip to Europe, she excitedly accepted the opportunity. She had long had the desire to know just a little more about the setting of foreign people in their own homes and in their own surroundings. She thrilled at visiting Westminster Abbey, the Louvre, Christopher Columbus's birthplace. Teas and parties were held in her honor by the Lord Mayor of London, by Lady Astor and Lady MacLeod. What a different world Europe was, far from the Jim Crow laws back home that wouldn't allow her to eat in restaurants and forced her to go through certain doors. In Europe, she was treated like royalty. We were wonderfully received there. My dark skin did not hamper them at all. They were very fond of me, and I liked them. When her group got to Vatican City, they were received by the Pope, the spiritual leader of the Catholic Church. They were assembled in a large room, and the Pope gave his blessing to the body, as he always did. Then everyone kissed his ring. But when the Pope came to Mary, he stopped and held his hands over her head and said something in Latin. Mary never knew what he said, but when she looked up, the men in her group were weeping, and strangely the attendant who was with the Pope put his arms about her shoulders and said, "Oh, blessed art thou among women." As she saw firsthand much of the poverty in the different countries she visited, she observed, "One gets many very different ideas. We are not the only sufferers and burden bearers in the world. I stiffened my back and got new courage to come back to America with greater appreciation for the blessings we did have." Back home in America, Mary was invited to a special luncheon by the mother of soon-to-be President Franklin D. Roosevelt. There were about 35 guests, but Mary was the only guest with dark skin. Two of the guests were ladies from the South. And as the announcement was made that lunch was to be served, these ladies were waiting for Mrs. Bethune to be escorted out. It was unheard of to sit at the same table. Anyone who allowed it would be socially ostracized. Imagine the startled looks on their faces as Mrs. Roosevelt graciously held out her arm to personally escort Mary Bethune to the table where she was seated as the guest of honor. She remembered how the faces of the servants lit up with pride when they saw her seated at the center of that imposing gathering of women leaders from all over the United States. Mrs. Roosevelt introduced her to her daughter-in-law, Eleanor, wife of Franklin, and they became immediate friends. Her circle of influence grew wider and wider, with appointments to various boards, committees, and even advisory roles to the presidents of the United States. She fought hard to open doors for her people. When asked what they wanted, she would reply without hesitation, "Protection that is guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States and which we have a right to expect. The opportunity for development equal to that of any other American. To be understood. And finally, to make an appreciable contribution to the growth of a better America and a better world." As conditions in the country became desperate in the Great Depression, President Roosevelt personally selected Mary to be the director of the Minority Affairs of the National Youth Administration, or the NYA. The appointment overwhelmed her, and her first inclination was to decline. But then she was reminded this was the first post created at such a high level for a black woman in the United States. Think of what it would mean to her people. She was paving the way for others to follow. She had accomplished so much in her life, overcoming so many insurmountable barriers. With her faith, she could surely do this. And so she went to work. "Let those who can read go out to teach the children who can't," Mary Bethune directed. Young men and women just out of school themselves, under her inspiration, gathered in the children of the sharecroppers who had no schools, and others who had not had an education and set up schools without buildings. In the NYA schools over the next few years, more than 1 million children got the basics of education. Reading did make a difference, but she didn't stop there. She set up projects in agriculture, shop work, and dressmaking. mothers' clubs were organized, bringing modern standards of health and childcare. More than 40,000 young people were able to complete their college work and obtain their degrees. Her desk was flooded with touching letters. "I'm a colored boy, 19 years old, and am in very bad need of work. Please help me get a place in the National Youth Administration. They say it helps poor boys and girls like me." Or, "I've been out of school for 5 school terms. I have no father, and my mother isn't able to work regular on account of a rundown condition. So you see, I must have work. So please help me." She crisscrossed the country looking for ways to help take care of their needs. For 10 years, she worked tirelessly for her children. President Roosevelt trusted her and depended on her. Once he said to her, "I'm always glad to see you, Mrs. Bethune, because you never ask for anything for yourself." She ignored her doctor's advice to slow down. There were just too many young people who needed her. But she had been distressed with a severe asthmatic condition for years and announced that she needed to undergo an operation. Now, this woman, who was the personal friend of presidents, who held a high rank in the national government, who was beloved by the millions of young people she had given hope to, still faced the cruel realities of Jim Crow. Upon entering Johns Hopkins Hospital, she was told there were no private rooms in the medical or surgical divisions where she should be for a black woman. A special gesture was made because she was so outstanding to place her in a room in a completely different part of the hospital. She soon discovered every nurse and every doctor on the staff were white. She persisted in a request to allow 2 distinguished black physicians in the city to participate in her case. She won, and from that time on, doctors of all races have been allowed on the staff at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Mrs. Bethune kept a careful diary of her 6 weeks there, and although she must have had times of severe pain, there were no records of complaints. Years before, John D. Rockefeller Sr. had given her his personal copy of The Optimist's Good Morning, a book of wise sayings and comforting thoughts she had read for years. Her own log always began with a cheery thought, "Thank God for light," or "Thanks for life," "Thanks for morning," "Glorious day, all my trust in thee." When World War II started, she spent countless hours writing words of encouragement and hope in letters. This 200-pound grandmother in her 60s became the unlikely pinup girl in lockers of servicemen all over the world. How they loved her, and how she loved them. The last 5 years of her life were spent at what was called The Retreat, a home that was built for her on a corner of the Cookman-Bethune campus. The school now covered 32 acres and had 14 beautiful buildings, surrounded by manicured lawns, dazzling flower beds, and tall, shady trees. She watched the students as they hurried from class to class. Did they know how dear a price had been paid for the opportunities they now enjoyed? She remembered how the school had been built on an old dump heap with just $1.50 in her pocket. Gone were the days of the white dress inspection tour. When she appeared dressed in white, everyone scrambled to their rooms to make sure no clothes had been stuffed under the bed or their rooms left untidy. The walls of her retreat were covered with photos and memories of her life of service. So much progress had been made, but there was still so far to go. She sat down to write her last will and testament. "Sometimes I ask myself if I have any legacy to leave. My worldly possessions are few, yet my experiences have been rich. From them, I have distilled principles and policies in which I firmly believe. Perhaps in them there is something of value. So as my life draws to a close, I will pass them on in the hope that this philosophy may give inspiration. Here, then, is my legacy. I leave you love. Love thy neighbor is a precept which could transform the world if it were universally practiced. I leave you hope. I leave you a thirst for education. I leave you faith. Without faith, nothing is possible. With it, nothing is impossible. Faith in God is the greatest power, but great faith, too, is faith in oneself. I leave you racial dignity. We must recognize that we are the custodians as well as the heirs of a great civilization. As a race, we have given something to the world, and for this we are proud. I leave you a desire to live harmoniously with your fellow men. I leave you finally with a responsibility to our young people. They must not be discouraged from aspiring toward greatness, for they are to be the leaders of tomorrow." One of Mary Bethune's biographers closes her story with these words. On the afternoon of May 18, 1955, Mary McLeod Bethune was rocking gently on her front porch. She rose and entered the house, and her heart suddenly stilled. She did not need time to make her peace with God. That had been done long ago, and they were companions. Beside her dearly beloved retreat, a hill was built, and what was left of earth was laid within it. In flowers above her was spelled out, "Mother," and anyone who listened with hope and belief might hear the strong echo of her voice. Life is wonderful. Bye-bye. See you next time.